CliffCentral.com.
That's right, and George will be with us on this show on Friday. We've also got a brand new episode of Blind History coming to you in the next half an hour, so stick around for that too. This morning we have Mash in the studio in Johannesburg, and we have Ruth in her house in Pretoria. Tell us a bit about you, Ruth. We don't even know that much about you. Tell us what you've been up to.
Okay,
where are you from? What do you do? All that kind of stuff.
Don't bore you with what I do on a day-to-day basis. But I decided in lockdown, shucks, I can't die of this plague and only have that I've, you know, ever just had a remedial job. So I decided to start my own little YouTube channel.
Yeah.
and just, you know, sort of express my ideas, my opinions, try and get people to start thinking out of the box. You know, I mean, what used to ick me really was that people still took their kids to circuses. I don't know if that's the correct plural for circus, anyway.
Circuses,
and,
right.
And they just don't, people, you know, they really follow the herd.
Mm-hmm.
And I was saying, have you ever had a thought of what happens behind the scenes? Do you ever think why that animal is doing what that trainer or that person waving a stick in front of them is doing? And that sort of really gave me the oomph. There's a terrible thing, and excuse for all the people who love animals in the comments and are listening.
Yeah.
But there's something that happens from March to September in a little town called Taiji.
Oh, is this where they kill all the whales?
The dolphins.
Dolphins, yeah.
The dolphins. They go out and hunt, capture them, and literally destroy pods and families. And it's horrific. And it's because the Japanese, look, every culture has their pros and cons, but they believe that dolphins are a scourge on the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, to me, that just didn't resonate. And I did a couple of shows on that. And there was an incredible also documentary on
So would you say
Netflix,
you're a bit of an activist?
A little bit, but I just want people to use their brains. Just use your heads, you know. When we have these scars, like there are so many people, especially in Joburg, with their little plot of land, you know, people will build their homes right up into the FSR of their boundary wall and have like a little patch of grass. And then what do? They go and buy a husky.
Yeah.
Because my huskies are so cute and nice, you know? You know, they are just like such, and they're big and they scare the criminals away. But no. So, and they never take the dog for a walk, and then the dog finally manages to escape, and then, oh, shame, my woofles is now gone.
Yeah.
And you don't, you know, people just don't think, and when it's exceedingly hot, like some temperatures that happen,
yeah,
there's no water.
No.
There's not enough water, and it just makes my blood boil. So,
We kind of know you from your comments on the show. I mean, you're here every morning basically, and there are a small group of people, and I've suggested to the producers that we try and get as many of you guys to kind of be a part of the show as possible, so we can actually see who you are as well. Some people don't want to; they prefer to just be kind of anonymous, use a pseudonym or whatever. But what is it? That comment section can get pretty hectic. And Rebellious Ruth is one of the people who comments all the time, and you guys get into arguments. There's some people who really don't like each other. There's some people who do. It's like a little, it's like a family, right? There's the drunk uncles, and there's the badly behaved teenagers and all of that stuff. Tell me what's going on in the comments section. Give me the real story, because I think you know more than I do.
Ooh. So often we have a couple of trolls that come on.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm so glad that George is here. He's like become active. It's awesome.
George
Meany. Welcome to the
club. Right. Okay.
He's like part of the plebs now, part of the peasants.
Yeah.
and I think the comedy, the camaraderie is awesome. Not so really. Like if people start picking on me in particular, I don't have time to waste. Like with your small fry ideas, you know, I couldn't give a hash what you think of me. As long as I'm allowed to say my say, well, you're allowed to say your say. If we disagree,
sure,
then we have to be adults about, you know. So, yeah, those are some of my views.
All right,
if you like
said,
what I have to say, please
You said you have a boring job, but I mean, there are boring jobs and there are boring jobs. So how boring are we talking here?
Okay, so I might get into a bit of shit for this, but I work for a gay, deaf Jewish man.
A gay, deaf
Wait, what?
Jewish man. My life is never boring.
Oh, that's not boring.
Well, he won in life.
Yeah.
Sure.
My life is never boring, but I'm PA to a...
Okay.
Yeah. All but right. He... It's interesting. It's interesting.
When you think of boring jobs, I wouldn't have put that one in there. I always think the most boring job must be like a Mash. What would be your security worst job? I'd hate to work in a
call center.
Yeah, call center. I was just about to say where you've got a whole bunch of people in this huge warehouse sized office and everybody's wearing headsets and they're all talking to these angry customers who don't want to hear from them. You know, like an insurance call center would be my worst nightmare.
Yes, that would be the worst of the worst.
Or security guard with like just a baton, like one security guard patrolling like,
yeah,
I don't know, some
a parking lot,
burnt out building.
Yeah.
Ruth, do you also know sign language?
No, he doesn't sign. Doesn't sign. No,
how
I've does just,
he, how do you guys to, communicate?
I shout a lot. I used to have a little voice. In fact, when I was at school, we did a cabaret. And my English teacher thought I had a bit of talent. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of... Yeah, what happened there? But it gave me, at least I can say he's given me a voice because now I shout a lot.
A couple of people talking about you here. First of all, there's Ruth is definitely a lover, not a fighter, says Tracy. Annette says, remember that Andre dickhead? Who's Andre? I don't know who you're talking about.
Who is that?
Someone wants to know, what is your podcast called, Ruth, Sam?
So it's on YouTube and it's Rebellious Ruth.
Okay. Ruth was the first one who made me feel at home in the comments section, says Mel. It's Melissa Peterson. Mm. Okay, that's nice of you. You see, that's
Ruth,
very nice.
Who's your top five in the comment section?
Yes.
Oh, now I'm going to. So obviously, Corona's boring and Carlos. By the way, I think I mentioned the joke about the Carlos. That's why I need to speak to George. but yeah, so it's I can't say top five. Corona's boring. Tracy, Carlos. Mm-hmm. Who else is there? I'm just gonna scroll. Marco's excellent dude. The guys are just so Annette's excellent, like lovely. Melissa, Derek Barker. Also enjoy Patrick. Yeah, a lot of the guys that are here today, Stevie, also incredible. Also Propaganda and I, like, you know, we connect.
You know everybody. You know them better than I do.
Yeah, it's kind of, we're missing Sinele. Sinele hasn't been around. I sent him a pizza koning. Also there. But always lovely to see more ladies on the chats.
Okay.
Always awesome all to right. see that. Well, Miku.
I like this because we get to have you on the show and we get to meet you and we must do this with more of the people in the comment section. It's always good. Ruth is always a pleasant person in the comments, says Yonder. All right. You're like the mayor. They're calling you the mayor. Theron says you're the mayor of the comment section. Is that true?
Sure. Well, subscribe to my channel, yo. Now, I do these crazy... I think I have like multiple personalities that come out on my channel as well. So I'll have like a serious discussion topic. And then to liven it up, I do like I have Charlene from Boxburg. Her IQ is like 65.
Okay. Is that the one you were talking about with the Huskies earlier?
Yes, that the one. Yeah. She is like, like that, you know? And, we do Charlene came to me. A lot of collaboration with lots of people. And then we also, I do a sort of an esoteric, holistic, astrological, like, and I know you're not into the whole elements, astrological thing, but it's full moon time and La Luna comes down and then La Luna gives readings and a little bit of fortune telling and a lot of mumbo jumbo, but it's lots of fun.
One thing I've got to thank you for is the reminders to like and subscribe, because I always forget to do that, and then people get into trouble and I get shat on in meetings. So please, I'm going to remind everybody now, like and subscribe. And George says the comment section puts me under extreme morning pressure, but I'm loving it. Makes the day better with Ruth and company. Oh, that's nice. You see, I think for a lot of people, it's kind of, you know, the original and proper definition of a community is that people get together and they share ideas and they laugh and they kind of, they have some fun. And it's the way that you have a routine in your day that kind of starts you off properly. I think for a lot of people, that's what it is. All right. Well, Mash, we got a couple of things we have to get to before we go all the way into blind history. Anything else on your agenda for this morning?
Hey, Gerefi, let's get into scams, because we've been discussing scams whole morning.
Oh, no. Well, I thought we finished this with Yaku. He'd already made us all fearful of what's going on our servers when we're not paying attention. What scams have you encountered lately?
So I went down the scam rabbit hole and I started actually doing some research on some of the most notorious scams throughout history, which basically set the precedent and set the bar for scams today. So we're going to start off with the Ponzi scheme. Okay. I mean, everybody knows the Ponzi scheme, but many people don't know where it originated.
Herbalife.
And it originated.
Didn't it start with him?
No, unfortunately, it did not. It didn't start with them. I have lots of friends who sell Herbalife, so I really can't say anything too bad about them as much as I want to.
The ancient Egyptian pyramid was the original pyramid scheme. Someone said to them, hey, guys, if we all pitch in and build this pyramid, then we'll have something really cool in 10,000 years to show off to humanity. And, of course, they all did, and now there's nothing. We think it's a tomb. So that was probably the original pyramid scheme. But Bernie Madoff is the most famous Ponzi schemer of our time, right?
Yes, he is one of the most famous. Mm. But the original, it was actually Charles Ponzi, who promised clients a 50% profit within 45 days or 100% profit within 90 days by buying discounted postal reply coupons in other countries and redeeming them at face value in the US as a form of arbitrage. In reality, Ponzi was paying earlier investors using the investments of later investors. And as you know, with any Ponzi scheme or pyramids, it topples once too many people join, because now the early investors have been paid all y'all money and there's no money for you new people.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, our bot in the comments says, send me 300 Rand and I'll tell you more about scams. All right. Carry on, Mash.
The second one has to be the miracle car scam. It was an advanced fee scam that ran from 1997 to 2002 by James R. Nicholas and Robert Gomez. In its run of just over 4 years, over 4,000 people brought 7,000 cars that did not actually exist, causing over $21 million US dollars stolen from the victims. Hmm. So people are just buying cars that just never existed, just based off of a promise, basically. Hmm. The third one has to be the Sir Drake estate fraud. This, now we're going back into like the horse and buggy days.
Okay.
And this scam, which took place over 70 years before coming to an end in 1936, involved 28 swindlers who convinced people all across America that a wealthy individual named Jacob Baker of Philadelphia had died, leaving his estate behind with no heirs. Victims were prompted to pay litigation fees to release the funds, which they'll receive 100-1 based off of the investment. First of all, 100-1, it doesn't even make sense.
No,
man. At all. And people fell for this back then.
We were talking about things that are too good to be true. I mean, this is a perfect example. Like, if someone's trying to sell you something and it just sounds too good to be true, it probably is too good to be true. Don't fall for that crap.
It absolutely is.
Oh.
Hmm. And then I have two more here. The first one is the Republic of Poyais. And this scam is where hundreds of people departed England and Scotland on voyages to the promising new country of Poyais. The would-be settlers were shocked to find out that the place promoted by Gregor MacGregor, I mean, oh with that God. Name, Gregor MacGregor, were in fact nothing but a desolate wilderness. So they were promised this heaven on earth, this Narnia, you know, type of place. And they all embarked.
Imagine being some like 15th century English or Scottish peasant, and you're like rummaging around in the mud trying to find something that's got a bit of protein to eat. And you know, you haven't washed in like 8 years, and like life is just fucking terrible. And then suddenly someone comes along and says to you, I have a ticket here. So it'll take you to the promised land. It's going to be amazing. There's milk and honey, and there's plenty to eat, and it's beautiful, and it's sunny, and it's clean, and it's not full of horrible people who are going to tell you what to do. And you buy it with all of your life savings, and you end up in some barren wasteland. Ugh. Poor fuckers.
Oh, mine's have 15 quid.
Yeah.
And then the last scam, this is actually the most exciting one. Emmanuel, his name is Nude. Okay. Emmanuel Nude is known as the biggest scammer in the history of Nigeria after he sold a fake airport to a Brazilian man called Nelson Sagaguchi for the sum of $242 million.
Yeah.
Together with five slightly loyal accomplices, Nude pulled off the impressive feat of impersonating the governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria successfully enough to convince Nelson Sagaguchi, a director of the Brazilian bank, Bekno Neruste. He then convinced Sagaguchi to invest in a new airport in the Nigerian capital of Abuja. He asked for a $10 million commission for negotiating the investment, while Sagaguchi happily dreamed of the airport he'd one day own a slice of. So happily, he forgot to ask to see the construction works or anything like that. Amazingly, Nude was caught after the Brazilian bank noticed that half of its capital was resting peacefully in the Cayman Islands. Oh. In total, Neruste lost $242 million from the scam, making it one of Nigeria's most heroic ever and causing some serious questions to be asked about how quickly Sagaguchi was willing to cough up cash to anyone who came to him with a slick story about airplanes.
It's you have to have a Nigerian at the top of that, right? Like the Nigerians are the kings and queens of scamming.
I mean, in America, they know Africa as like a place where we just scam people because that's their usual interaction with Africans. It's always a Nigerian prince or some Nigerian kid who wants to buy
some sex god that can give you the immortality and pleasure zones to fulfill every woman or man's dream sexually or something crazy.
Mm-hmm. give me that number, Ruth.
so look at this. Arbot says some millionaire lost $100 in a scam about a building that needed to be built. Well, I mean, it's the same as this guy with the airport, right? Another famous scam in history is the Spanish prisoner scam. Today we call it the Nigerian prince scam. That's true. And according to Super Jacob Zuma, 1820 English settlers were scammed into thinking South Africa was the promised land. And then, of course, they landed in the Eastern Cape and they were like, oh, my fuck. Is this what you guys have promised us? I mean, like, it promised us this, the Eastern Cape, right?
Yo. Mm. But there were some punishments for Nude, of course. So Nude only spent a few years in jail for the fraud, but a decade later found himself back inside on charges of murder and terrorism. Mm. It's so nice to see he's keeping himself busy.
Well, I mean, this is what George says, and he's right. It just shows that parting with money is more about trusting a person than the actual analysis of the deal. I wonder how many scams are as a result of people you know. Well, isn't it true that most people who've been ripped off have been ripped off by people they know? Not complete strangers.
Word.
Yeah, so you've got to be super careful about that stuff. I think that's
more people. They say, sorry, Gareth.
No, go on.
No, they say that obviously when terrible things happen to you, it's from people you know. It's the people that you trust and allow into your inner circle that actually end up stabbing you in the back, which is so sad. So sad.
Now, before we go to blind history, you mentioned that you watched Kevin Fraser over the weekend, obviously on the internet, right? Or did you see him in person doing a show?
No, live.
Oh, wow.
Went to a live show.
So Kevin Fraser, for those people who don't know, very, very talented South African, what would you call him, comedian. I mean, he's a comedian, obviously. He's got all these characters, though. He does these accents and these. He's superb. He really is very, very talented. I bumped into him, what, 3 weeks ago, 2 weeks ago, after a dinner that I was at. And we didn't talk for long, but what a guy, huh? Really, really smart and very funny.
Yes, very smart, very funny, down to earth. And he just says it like he is. I mean, says like, yeah, like everything just happens, you know. One of the things that I'm going to just highlight that he mentioned now with all the load shitting, where some people forget that they've left an appliance on, or they've, you know, I'm sure for some woman, like my hair looks so frazzled this morning because I didn't exactly have a hairdryer to like continue the process. But we'll deal with it. So excuse the mad hair this morning. And he says, like, you'll be sleeping and all of a sudden the lights come back on, and literally the lights come back on and the hairdryer's going and the computer's loading up again, yeah, and it's the Netflix logo. And he's just so witty and he's so on the ball. And he just,
he's brilliant.
He just brings it home. He just makes you and feel funny. Human and laugh. He's a fantastic guy.
He's got a good grip on South Africa and like what makes South Africans laugh, which is a tough thing to do. You should do a blind history according to Corona's Boring.
All right.
William Turner.
Cannot hear Gareth at the moment.
Sorry, there we go. Is that better? Sorry, guys. Yes. Yeah, I was just saying that Kevin Fraser, obviously he gets what it is to be funny, but in South Africa, I mean, that's a special gift, you know, to be able to like read what makes South Africans laugh. Corona's Boring says you should do a blind history on William Turner, aka Devil Bill, aka Dr. Bill Livingston, the original snake oil salesman. Whew. Yeah, scammers. It's not a bad idea. That would be interesting.
Doesn't he have a movie about him? I think there's a movie about it.
It's the first I've heard of the guy.
I'll have to check.
All right. quickly, apparently MASH is done with Apple. He is no longer going to be a sheep. He's no longer buying Apple products. You are finished with them. Are you sure, MASH? Because people have said this before and then they go running back to Apple with their tail between their legs.
Gareth, I am absolutely sure. So yesterday I went to a phone launch event for Xiaomi. Mm-hmm. And they're launching some Android phones here in South Africa.
Yeah.
And I use some of these phones. These phones are priced actually below my phone, for starters, below these iPhones that we're using. And the features, the camera, everything about it was just so impressive. And I thought to myself, first of all, half of these features we don't have. Literally half of the features on this thing we don't have. And we're going to get them in probably 2 years, 3 years time. And once we get them, we'll be like, oh, it's the best thing on earth. But it's like other people have had these for years. I know that this is the argument that Android people usually come with, but I'm beginning to see it. I'm not saying that I'm going to buy one tomorrow. I'm just saying that Ryan is already commenting, don't lie. No, but seriously, I am not saying I'm going to buy one tomorrow, but I am saying that there is more out there. There is more out there. I've learned that everybody's just attacking me in the comment section, actually, about switching over. But I am convinced, Gareth, our phones are not all that. There is more out there.
Well, Ryan says, MASH is being paid a shit ton of money for this ad by the Chinese. Steve says, once you go Mac, you don't go back. A lot of people are saying you're making a terrible mistake. Ooh, you see how tribal people get around phones? Are you very uptight about what kind of phone you use, Ruth, or do you not give a shit?
No, I don't give a shit. Fuck the car drive. As long as it gets me from A to B, I don't care.
Well, a lot of people are very uptight about this. Rusty says, AdB says, Apple fanboys. Rusty says, I'm with you, MASH. MASH is right, says Congo Chris.
Yes.
Oof. Okay. Lots of different opinions.
Now that you guys, everyone who thinks I'm right, I'm starting a Facebook group. It's my own little cult of people who side with me on this.
Okay.
You guys might have to pay a membership fee. But let's have some fun and explore. Let's explore and keep our minds open because we cannot be sheep forever. There is more out there.
Well, Artie Pandey says, I have a Xiaomi phone. I'll never go back to Samsung. Super Jacob Zuma says, no ways. I bought a Poco, which is a Xiaomi budget, for under 5K and its power. Kutle says, welcome to the Android family. Good on you, MASH. Don't listen to these troglodytes. Carl says, shut your mouth. Android is for the poor. All right, we're going to leave it at that. Ruth, thanks for being on the show this morning. It was good to meet you properly for the first time. And we'll talk to you soon. Also, go and check out Rebellious Ruth on YouTube. We will be back tomorrow with more live in between 6 and 8 o'clock and lots of good things, lots of cool people. We've only got a few shows left until the end of the year. I mean, before you know it, right? What is today? Mm-hmm. Today is the 22nd. Yeah, so tomorrow, it's basically one more month of shows, and then we're done. We're finishing the day before Christmas Eve. So that's the whole bang shoot in one bag. We will see you tomorrow. But before we go, here's a little blind history for you. Brand new episode. Anthony Meader and I talk about two really amazing people from the medieval era who I think you will love. They were like the original power couple, and both of them were extraordinary people. Take a listen. Here's Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine. The fiery, furious relationship between the medieval era's most famous power couple led to glory and terrible failure. Their empire was the greatest in the West since the time of Charlemagne. He was 9 years younger than her, but she matched his energy. When they weren't making love and producing another of many children, they were plotting against each other, or fighting like cat and dog. She took no prisoners, but he made her one for 15 years. The world, it seems, wasn't big enough for Henry II of England and Eleanor of Aquitaine. Blind History, we're approaching the end of the latest season, and we've had so many interesting emails from people and people requesting all kinds of things. And one thing that we thought we'd struggle with at the beginning of this is to find enough women of history. And, you know, Ant and I would sit there and we'd wring our hands and we'd call out to the sky and go, oh, if only we had more interesting people to talk about. But there actually, through the course of these seasons, you'll see have been plenty of powerful women. There is not one powerful woman who even comes close in the medieval era to this incredible woman, the redoubtable, the powerful, the mighty Eleanor of Aquitaine. And obviously, we're featuring her and her husband, Henry II, in this episode. But actually, I think this came about, Ant, because you and I love the medieval period. We love the English royal family. We love the Plantagenets. But what we like especially about this is it's this love story intertwined into power and war and medieval Europe and so much other stuff that's going on.
Yeah, I absolutely love Henry and Eleanor. Queen Elizabeth, as you know very well, is on both sides, both marriages, there's connections.
Yeah.
So this lineage is very strong and powerful. And another thing that I really love about history is everything's interconnected in some way. If we look at Rola, the mad Viking, that massive Viking, William the Conqueror was his great-grandson, and Henry II, his great-grandfather was William the Conqueror. So that lineage is insane. And this era was where these kings and queens, they need to go out on their horses and go and sort the enemy out themselves. It was a chivalry. There was romance. There was conniving. Everything that you can possibly think of happened in this period now.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, both Henry II and Eleanor were related also. They were even more closely related than Eleanor and her first husband, the King of France, who she divorced on grounds of them being too closely related. So it's full of intrigue. But let's just talk about this remarkable woman, first of all, because I don't think Henry would have been nearly the success that he was. And he was a force to be reckoned with throughout his life. But he wouldn't have been nearly the man that he turned out to be if he hadn't married this extraordinary woman. She was of Southern French origin. Her grandfather was William the Troubadour, the first king who used to compose songs and poems. He was this romantic figure, probably one of the most famous dukes of Aquitaine. And she inherited all of that, plus her own father's warrior spirit. And he raised her as a man, you know, not that she was, you know, confused about her gender identity, but he raised her in the arts of war, of hunting, of horse riding, of how nations needed to be run. She was a properly well-schooled, well-educated young woman.
Yeah, first in literature, philosophy, avid horse rider and led a very active life. And she inherited her father's title and the extensive lands very young. I mean, she was around 15 years old upon his death. And also, she had a brother. He also died.
Yeah, he predeceased her. I think he died at like age 4, along with their mother.
Yeah, so then she was the sole heir, and then
she was the most desirable woman in Europe, without a doubt. She was what these days they would call, you know, like a really good match for anybody. And here was this woman with these, you mentioned, vast lands. I mean, when Eleanor inherited Aquitaine, Poitou, Gascony, all of these provinces from her father upon his death, she actually owned more of territorial France than the King of France. That's how powerful how rich she was. So naturally, you know, you have a young woman of that age running around France. She becomes a target for ransom, for kidnapping, and pretty much the first nobleman that can get to her and successfully wed her and have a child with her inherits this extremely large kingdom, which was a duchy at the time, and plenty of wealth with it.
And along came King Louis. I think he was Louis the Sixth, but he became Louis the Seventh upon his father's death. Mm-hmm. He first of all set up, when her dad died, sort of surrounded and protected her in inverted commas. And then in the end, the marriage happened. So she was then effectively Queen of France when his father passed away. So she was already now a queen.
Right. Now, her husband was called Louis Le Jeune, the Young, but he was a very pious man and wasn't very interesting to her. You know, she was this fiery woman with, you know, passion and temper and a lust for power and this really sharp wit and intelligence. And this guy was a bit of a drip. I mean, he was not particularly skilled in the art of war. He was very much devoted to the church, and that was not his fault. He was raised as the second son to go into the church. Unfortunately for him, his elder brother died and he was suddenly given the crown, and he was wholly unprepared for this. You know,
but he was besotted with Eleanor.
Shame, yeah. I mean, shame.
yeah. So, and definitely she was the one forcing the annulment, you know. Yeah. Although it was the fact that she couldn't give him a male heir. We're not sure what went on behind the scenes, but they did have two daughters, I believe.
Yeah.
But effectively, you're 100% right. She was, you know, she, with her personality and the way she was, it was never going to work between the two of them.
Well, apparently the Pope had to actually force them to sleep together on their return from a part of the Second Crusade. They stopped off in Rome. She was looking to annul the marriage because she'd had enough of him. He just didn't do anything for her anymore. He blamed her for losing a very famous battle in the Holy Land on their way to Antioch. He also, you know, were rumors, there was gossip about her having an affair with her uncle Raymond in Antioch. Whether or not that's true, we'll never know. But what was interesting is that when they got to Rome, the Pope said he's going to bless them specially. He took them into a room where he'd prepared a big bed for them. He was basically saying, right, you two, get on with it. And they did. They did actually conceive a child. And she was born a little while later. But these two daughters are much more kind of mysterious because they fall out of history very quickly. And then it moves on, as did Eleanor very quickly.
Yeah, I think that Eleanor got a bad rep. So first of all, maybe the fact that she was sleeping with certain people. There was talk of her sleeping with William Marshall. He was the famous knight. And also with, like you said, Raymond. She spent a lot of time with Raymond. And then also Geoffrey of Aquitaine, Henry's father, Henry II, who we'll speak about just now. There was talk also about her having an affair of sorts with him. But, you know, as like a lot of the people that we've spoken about, it's very much down to who's written the story. And there's always some hidden agenda going on. And there's very little proof that any of these things did, in fact, happen.
Well, you know, it's also typical of men at the time that whenever a woman was powerful or influential or seemed to have the upper hand, it must have been because she was sleeping with someone. And I think Eleanor comes off quite badly in the hands of medieval chroniclers, even though if you'd met her, you'd probably think this is not a woman who needs to sleep her way to the top. She had all the tools at her disposal and the brain to be able to figure out her way to the top without any of these guys even knowing what had hit them. And that brings us really to Henry, who I know is a favorite of yours. in medieval kings, because he was every bit the king that England needed at the time. You know, they'd come out of the Civil War. Henry II was this just unbelievably energetic human being. He could ride for days at a time on horseback. And of course, being here at one point and there at another made you just terrifying to people, because they thought, how did he get here so quickly? They never knew where he'd pitch up. He had complete control of his kingdom. He was remorseless.
He was constantly on the move, highly energetic, a force of nature. He was called the Alexander of the West at times because of the vast lands that he'd owned or inherited, or he took it by a siege. So it's all the way from Scotland and the Highlands, from Scotland all the way to the Pyrenees. But when he came, I think the realm just breathed a sigh of relief. Henry I, who was his grandfather, he had male heirs, but the male heir died in the ship wreck. And so the only real heir was Matilda, and she was feisty in herself. And she hung around quite a bit much later than Henry did, Henry I. Matilda was told by her father that she'd be the successor to his throne, but that never transpired. Stephen, who was a cousin of hers, got the throne. And there was civil war because a lot of the nobles didn't want him as king, etc., for whatever reasons. So it was a really difficult time for the realm. And when Henry came along, it just gave it the solidity. He cleaned things up very quickly. He was very, very astute in terms of law and administration, which we don't often talk about. We often talk about the warrior side. There's lots of things that he did at that time that are still relevant today.
Yeah, and he was an impressive guy. I mean, he was already, I think, 9 years younger than Eleanor when he married her. And they almost had to rush to do it because, again, there were all these men after her. And her whole life would be spent either running towards men, running away from men, or trying to manage men. And this was going to be accompanied by the fact that there were all these very, very strong male influences, but also people like Matilda, who was an example of, you know, a woman who tried to hold her own at a time where those were very difficult things to do. She and he got along really well in the beginning. They produced, how many kids were there? 9 kids. Which is absolutely amazing. She was a mother of 9 children. Now, if you think about it, these days we rightly are impressed by someone who can raise 3 or 4 kids. Mm. This woman had 9. Some of them were boys, and they fought with each other all the time, and she would sometimes take their sides, even against their father. But for a few years there, they had a happy marriage, and it seems they were genuinely in love. And while she probably influenced him in some ways, he also influenced her in some ways. But constantly keeping the borders of this enormous realm in play were, you know, these were their preoccupations. This was a full-time job for Henry and for Eleanor.
They said he spent 14 years of his reign in England, which is fair enough because he owned half of France together with Eleanor. But that's only half of his reign. So he's just over 30 years, I think, was his reign. So he needed to spend time in his French territories as well as in England. And I think he just had the right amount of energy. And as you mentioned earlier, constantly on the move, he did everything on the move, and it worked.
They eventually called the empire that he ruled over the Angevin Empire. Anjou was where his father, Geoffrey of Anjou, was from. And they called it the Angevin Empire. He partially controlled Scotland, the Duchy of Brittany, Ireland, much of territorial France, but he was only really accepted in the south of France because of Eleanor. She had to go out there and convince all of these vassals of hers that Henry was their boss as well, because without her, he wouldn't have had control over all of that. But there was constantly this tension between France and England. And the French crown, you know, went from being very influential and powerful to being completely worthless at various stages through this up and down. And the king who eventually turned it around for France was Philippe Augustus, is who we call him. He took over after Eleanor's ex-husband, Louis VII, died. So it's hard to keep track of these things, but essentially what ended up happening was that Henry II and Eleanor's children eventually started to fight with each other and bicker, mostly the boys. The eldest of them who survived was Henry the Young King, who was this again, perfect medieval king in some ways. You could joust, could fight, could lead an army to battle. But he was also a very vain, very proud, very spoilt little guy. And ultimately also started arguing with his father to the point where Henry II, and he had so many arguments, he was traveling through southern France and caught dysentery and realized he was going to die. And the first thing he wanted to do after that was make up with his dad, because they'd been fighting for most of their adult lives.
I think the big thing that the sons had was that the dad was outwardly compliant, inwardly defiant. He had total control. He didn't want to release any control. And I think it was more them and then their mom standing by them rather than Eleanor actually acting against Henry II.
I think you're right to mostly absolve Eleanor of the blame, although Henry gave her most of the blame when he put her in prison in 1173, and he kept her in there for 15 years. And 15 years is not a short space of time.
No.
This woman wasn't kept in like a dungeon. She had her own household. She had a good living. She got lots of exercise, was allowed to ride her horse around and hunt and do all the things that she'd done before. But she was estranged. She'd be brought out for important family occasions and for Christmas and that sort of thing. And when Henry needed her to win over his barons in the south.
But there was also talk about her having the court of love. And I think that was just a little bit before she was locked up. But she was estranged by then, let's say, from Henry. And so she stayed in Poitiers and established together with her daughter a court where people could come. And she would hear people's issues, etc., but a place of poetry, of love, of philosophy, and it became actually quite famous.
Do you think that Eleanor and Henry had a lifelong kind of love for each other? Because Henry definitely had other women, and she'd obviously had other men both before him, and we're not sure after. But they seem to have been like star-crossed lovers. You know, in some ways, they were fated to be together, even though they were both such powerful alpha human beings.
There's no doubt. I don't think that Henry could find anybody in his lifetime that could match Eleanor. And I think that Eleanor was satisfied, let's say, with Henry II. I mean, he was energetic. He had massive angers at times, but he never held grudges. He was stubborn, but intelligent. I think that there wasn't anybody on the planet that could satisfy any one of them but themselves.
Sure. So she did. You mentioned she already used to take the sides of some of her children. Her favorite was undoubtedly Richard. And Richard would end up taking over after Henry II died as King of England. And then obviously she'd already installed him as Duke of Aquitaine as well. So when he came along, it made sense for her to look after things for him. She'd been in prison in England for 15 years, which is more time than Henry II spent in England. So she knew the place, and she kind of took over as regent because all Richard wanted to do was go to the Crusades.
And it just shows you the relationship they had with their mom. There was so much talk that she was a bad mom, just nipping back to the two daughters from Louis VII. Mm-hmm. Oh, but she didn't have a relationship. Well, she was not allowed to have a relationship. That's the way it worked in those days. That was not her property. Those two daughters were taken into the French court. So that wasn't any doing of hers. And then all of the sons on young Henry's deathbed, he just wanted his dad to release Eleanor from prison. He wants to release his mom from prison. Richard used her to run his realm while he was fighting the Crusades. And she was very instrumental during John's reign.
You know, we talked about William Marshall in a previous episode of Blind History. He was alive and around at the same time. And it just shows you that no man is an island, right? You have Henry II, Richard I, John, and all three of these kings rely not only on William Marshall in a big way, but all three of them also rely very heavily on Eleanor of Aquitaine.
Correct.
And she's this not so quiet influence in the background. You know, this powerful woman who has her own territories. She has her own reason to stand on her own two feet and not particularly care what these men are all up to. But she helps her sons in various ways in order to establish themselves as kings. And without her, Richard could never have run England from afar.
Her progeny were the three kings of England, just her immediate progeny, so it's, which was incredible and unusual at the time. But I think a big part of Henry was at least a little bit of balance in Henry's life, because Henry was impetuous And I think that she did help. And you said earlier, rightly so, that I don't think Henry could have got to the heights that he did if it wasn't for her. Besides the fact that Aquitaine was put under his realm, there was just so much more. And even the Thomas Becket saga, which I think is a very, very important thing that tarnished Henry II's reign. Thomas Becket was appointed by Henry as his chancellor. They were very, very close. Effectively, it was like, if we think of Queen Elizabeth now, it's her prime minister. But Henry made a mistake, I mean, in hindsight, in that he appointed him the Archbishop of Canterbury and expected Thomas Becket to toe the line, like he'd done throughout his tenure as the chancellor. But what happened was Thomas Becket flipped 100%, did a 360-degree turn. There's discussions, reasons why. It was maybe he felt like he never belonged as an archbishop, as a man of the cloth, and he had to keep proving himself. So he became extremely dogmatic and vociferous in his protection of the cloth and everything to do with the Pope and religion.
Yeah, I think you've just illustrated such a good point, and maybe your theory is the right one, that he was trying to prove himself. But it's also that you have two bosses. You know, you have two gods that you report to as this early archbishop, because you've got a king in England and you've got the Pope in Rome. And there might have also been a little bit of pride. There might have also been advancement. You know, suddenly you're responsible to the head of the whole Catholic Church in Europe, and this is the way to your afterlife. And on the other hand, you've got Henry, who made the terrible mistake of one drunken night saying, "Will someone rid me of this turbulent priest?" Mm-hmm. Two of his knights who were in attendance heard this and thought, "Ha, we'll do that for you. We're drunk enough. We're loyal enough." They got on their horses, rode off to Canterbury, and slaughtered poor Thomas à Becket at the altar of Canterbury Cathedral. I mean,
While he was praying,
there's still a marker there. Yeah. To, you know, he's a saint. He's regarded as the martyr, the first proper martyr of post 1066 England. And poor Henry never really got over this, because he didn't hate Thomas. He didn't want to murder him. It was a fit of drunken rage. He wasn't sure what, you know, role he'd played in it. And it really seems to have had a terrible psychological influence and impact on him. After that, he became very pious, and he made all sorts of offerings and gave lots of lands back to the church and did all kinds of things that he might not have done if not for guilt. And all of this affected his reign too, because now he has no one he can rely on to run England. His wife is turning on him with his sons. His sons are all turning on each other and on him. He must have felt very lonely.
Historians are very harsh on him for that part of his reign and what happened. I think we'll never know, you know, if behind closed doors, said we need to take him out. I think a lot of people believe that he didn't. But it was a big turning point. I think the big failures in his reign was the Archbishop of Canterbury's murder, and also the fact that his sons just didn't have a lot of love for their father.
No, and I think, you know, some of them came round, and because he was such a powerful man, they fought and vied for his attention and affection a lot of the time. And maybe they didn't get enough of that. Maybe he was a terrible father. You could probably say Eleanor was a very good mother and she stood by her sons, but she was also the only person who could ever stand up to Henry. He was so powerful. Mm-hmm. And ultimately they are buried next to each other in Fontevraud Abbey, which is, you know, the effigies are still there, despite, you know, all those churches in France being looted during the revolution. And these two effigies lie next to each other as if they still are in perfect harmony. Of course, we know that during life there was no harmony. Well, not for a very long time. So it's quite lovely to see these two unbelievably, what would you even call them? Just, you said earlier with Henry, a force of nature. I think they both were. And in all of their children, a little bit of that, you know, power in that bloodline began with both of these two. And it may have been the source of so much of England's glory and so much of England's woes.
And the romantic in me hopes that they, you know, that they did love each other. I saw The Lion in the Winter, that movie. You could see clearly in that they still loved each other, you know, that they would scream and shout and rant and rave, but they did love each other. And they are, like you correctly have said, they're lying together. Actually, I think Richard was also, the effigy was also there, the That's three right. of them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very special that they're there together.
Yeah, of course, they may have produced a line of incredible kings, including, you know, the great Edward I and Edward III, possibly the greatest medieval kings. Henry II is among those number. But they also produced the worst, John, Richard II, Edward II, you know. So this is the beginning of so many things that made Britain and before that England the amazing country that it is, and gave it this amazing history. So an incredible place to start. And the first real Plantagenet king being Henry II, it was the beginning of a dynasty that would last for hundreds of years.
There is people trying to find out the living Plantagenets, you know, because it was such an incredibly powerful lineage.
And the name comes from a broom plant, and he used to wear a little twig of this broom plant in his hat, and the bloom is called the Plantagenista. So that's where it comes from, Plantagenista, Plantagenet. He was the first to use the surname, and the device, of course, of the three lions, which is still on the England cricket team's shirt. It's the Queen's coat of arms, and it became the coat of arms of the country of England. Those three lions, gold lions on the red background, that's Plantagenet. So that's where these two started their amazing dynasty.
And if you look at the size of his realm, that for me is something that's just incredible.
And it's also just worth saying again, because of Eleanor and her amazing influence on all of this, that even right at the end of her life, she was still trying to arrange dynastic marriages, and she went and fetched her granddaughter from Castile to bring her in to marry the new Dauphin of France. And this woman, just right up to her 82nd year, was still going strong.
82 years old in 1190 or whatever it was. It's just insane.
Phenomenal. That's them, Eleanor and Henry. Thanks for listening to this episode of Blind History. Every episode is available on the Cliff Central app, cliffcentral.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. In the next episode, he at one point was the richest man in the world. At one point, he was asked to help the U.S. Air Force with plans for planes. He also slept with some of the most beautiful women in Hollywood. The guy just seems to have lived 10 lives in one. CliffCentral.com